I remember walking into a living room of a couple that had worshiped with us at Highway 65 for several years, and seeing both of them as broken as I've ever seen two human beings. Their son had declared atheism about 6 months prior to this, and they had asked to see us, and on a Sunday afternoon, he had committed suicide. I have etched into my mind being with a dear, very faithful sister in the Lord, whose husband was also very faithful, who had been fighting colon cancer. And we were at UAMS in Little Rock, Arkansas. And they did have hope of a particular surgery they were going to do. It was going to be a long surgery. It was going to be very invasive. And they had only been involved in that particular procedure for about 30 minutes, and there was a call. And the call was that this was inoperable. I can remember holding my wife when she had had a miscarriage of our child, and the pain and the hurt that was there, and the questions that naturally are there. And I will never forget sitting by my mother's bedside in her last moments as she was taking her last breaths before she passed into eternity, and I believe into the paradise of her reward. And as I've been sharing that with you in these very few minutes, I'm sure as you were thinking about what I was saying, you too may have lost dear loved ones. You too have had suffering and pain. And that pain and suffering brings up a lot of questions. It is very worthwhile for us simply to consider, in thinking about the reality of suffering, to consider how to deal with suffering. And the Bible really is, of course, the wonderful resource God has given us in which we can see various things we do in times of suffering to grow in our faith and to grow closer to God. While we won't be really addressing that part, it does certainly need to be addressed and something that we want to think about as children of God, even in our times of suffering, to even prepare our minds for how we want to respond. So I realize what we're going to talk about tonight regarding suffering won't so much touch on that, but I do think it is very important. And it is really, I think, the challenging part of even the existence of suffering. How do we reconcile the notion of God and who God is and His love and His mercy and His grace and His righteousness and His holiness and all of those kinds of things and the very sin-sick, broken, suffering world in which we live? And I promise you, if you have a conversation with a very informed, and even some who aren't so informed, atheist, that will be one of the very first questions that you receive. I can also tell you that when your children or grandchildren, especially if they attend a state university, were to go into philosophy class, and that's usually a pretty early requirement for at least most majors, that they may well have a professor who doesn't believe in God. And he's going to be asking them these kinds of questions. So if we don't talk about it as Christians, as parents, as a spiritual family, and within our physical families, we're not equipping one another to defend the truth of the gospel. And there are some people who question the existence of God sincerely that ask this question. And they would like to know, how would a Christian respond? There are others who seem to use this as some type of mantra for their unbelief in God. And I would say there are probably some other reasons as well why they don't want to believe in God. And that is often the case. But still, as a Christian, shouldn't we think about this? Shouldn't we at least study this as we think about the notion of suffering and how that even harmonizes with God? And you may say, well, there's a lot of things I don't understand. Well, I'll say with you, there's a lot of things I may not understand. But I actually believe that the evidence of the existence of God is lying beneath the surface of even this question. And that it is the Christian that has a much more reasonable, logical defense of the existence of God, even when you look at suffering, even though from the outside it may not appear that way. So if you'll hang with me tonight, and you have so far this week, so why stop now? If you'll hang with me, I think you'll see what I'm talking about regarding this very important issue. We sometimes say bad things happen to good people. And they do, don't they? While it's true God sends rain on the just and the unjust, because we live in the world we live in, with all of the blessings of God around us and all of the beauty, there is still suffering. So, if we're going to get this question, if our families are going to get this question, we live in a very secularized society, they're going to be offering this argument against God. I really don't think the approach is to stick our head in the sand and say, I don't know, but I still believe. We need to think about it. And you know, the thing is that some of the most faithful servants of God cried out to God, didn't they? And it's not always bad to ask why. Now, for me to know all the answers to the question of why, I would have to be God Himself. And I'm not, and you're not. And we recognize that. We recognize that God is transcendent to us. He's beyond us. He is above us. And we submit to His guidance. We also know from Deuteronomy 29:29 that there are some things that are the secret things. And they belong to the Lord. Those are the things He hasn't revealed. So just because God hasn't revealed something to us, doesn't mean He has no answer for it. But then there are things that He has revealed. And Moses says in Deuteronomy 29:29 that those things belong to us and to our children. So here's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to try to think logically as much as possible about those things that have been revealed. So we don't have to feel ashamed of this idea that suffering can be a challenge to our faith from the surface standpoint. In fact, if we turn to Job, look at Job. You know the story of Job, I'm sure. But you know Job was never told why all this happened. I mean, we have an idea why it happened. We have the background story to this story of Job. But Job never really got the background story that I can read and find in the Scripture. He came to appreciate the glory of God. He came to realize that what was more important than the why is the who. And the who is God. And I really believe the book of Job is more about God than it is about Job. And you get to the end of Job and those divine speeches about God's love and God's grace and God's power. And Job came to understand that. And all the way through Job, he's saying, if I could just make my case before God, then I would argue this. And of course, when he actually comes into the presence of God, he's quiet. Now, he has some miserable friends, that's for sure. But in Job chapter 1, you'll notice in verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, from roaming about on the earth and walking around on it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. Can you imagine God and Satan are having a conversation and God decides to use you as exhibition A? Here is a faithful servant of mine. So here's exhibit A and he uses your name. For Satan. Now Satan comes back, and think about what happens here. Satan comes back, and he says, wait a minute, are you saying Job fears you for nothing? In other words, you've built this hedge around him, you've protected him, you've blessed him, you've given him all these things. He has wealth and prosperity, and if you take that away from him, because Satan believes everybody has a price, because he certainly had a price. Have you ever noticed people that steal think everybody's stealing from them? And people that lie think everybody's lying to them. So Satan's looking at this and says, well, look, everybody has their price, and he has his price too. And if you'll take all this away, and of course we know the story, and really God's faithfulness in Job comes out in this particular book. And we can continue reading that, but what I want you to see is, you know, very early on, this whole issue of God and suffering and the world and physical suffering and faith and that dynamic and how that all interacts is addressed in the Scripture. And there are many others that we might notice. We've read so far this week from the 73rd Psalm and Asaph's struggle. Now, eventually he says, I went into the sanctuary of God, and then I understood therein. But when he was looking, he said, I was envious at these ungodly people that seemed to be prospering. And so it is an issue. So let me try to present to you tonight at the very beginning, really the argument that most unbelievers have that we will be presented with and that we are being presented with. And this isn't a new argument, but this is the argument. And we're going to wrap this thing around the sermon tonight. So we're going to come back to the conclusion of this argument, but we're going to unravel it. We're going to, you know, this is kind of nuts and bolts night. We're going to take it apart and ask some questions. But these are things that can be helpful if we're faced with that. You may say, well, look, I don't know that I'm going to be faced, but your children and grandchildren may be faced with it. And they may ask questions. There was a man by the name of J.L. Mackey. He was an Australian philosopher. And he held, and others have just basically repeated this argument, but he held that when you look at God's goodness, and he's arguing from the same point, this is what you believe as a Christian. Okay, so you as a Christian believe in God's goodness, and you believe in God being all-powerful, and you believe God is benevolent toward his creation. We're going, yeah, check mark, check mark, check mark. And yet, with all of those attributes, God's love and God's goodness and God's mercy and God's compassion and God's justice, there's all this suffering. And there are many innocent people that suffer that we see. And that's a reality. And so here would be his argument. Either you have to argue that God doesn't exist and that's why there's suffering, or you have to give up on God's attributes and then you don't really have the God that you think you have. Now, this is basically the argument. In other words, human suffering that we see all around us is incompatible with the existence of God. That's the argument. I mean, you can say it a lot of different ways. So here's how the skeptic's argument goes. The God of the Bible, he says, is immoral and unjust, and therefore he doesn't exist. And the reason we think he's immoral, the skeptic says, is because look at all the suffering around us. So here's really our question. How can God be loving and merciful and just and there be suffering? So that's the argument. So let's say you're having a conversation with a friend that says, you know, I don't know if I believe in God. And they bring up this argument. What would you say? Well, you might say, well, I'm way ahead of you, Bruce. I've already read your outline. So I would go down the line. Or I have said this in the past or that in the past. But we might respond with, well, I don't really know what I would say in that moment. And I can understand that. So this seems like a very intimidating argument, but I want you to stay with me tonight. It is actually, the argument itself is actually a self-contradicting argument. And so when you just get it and you're kind of flat-footed and somebody says, oh, okay, let's talk about suffering in God, you might say, I don't know exactly where to begin. But here's what I'm going to suggest. I actually think this is the most simple approach. I want to give you some questions tonight that you can ask. So usually we're put on the defensive as Christians. What I'm saying is, no, let's come back with some fundamental questions. And I'll try to give you some of those questions this very evening. So you might say, well, Bruce, what do you mean by self-contradictory? There is a man by the name of Frank Turek. He's not a member of the Lord's Church. He's an apologist for the existence of God. But he has a really good book entitled Stealing from God. And basically what he argues is the atheist has to plagiarize concepts about God to deny the existence of God. But the only way for those concepts to exist is if God does exist. Let me give you an example. So the atheist says, well, that would be unjust. Or the atheist says, that would be immoral. Or the atheist would say, you know, that would be evil. What's wrong with it so far? Because the atheist doesn't have any way to validate that there even exists a thing such as evil or good, because he doesn't believe there's any objective standard. It's what he feels. This society may think one way, another society thinks another way. Who came up with the standard of evil? I mean, what you think is evil may be entirely different than what I think is evil. And who's to say you're right and I'm not? And are we just talking about survival of the fittest here and what we decide as a society is best for us? And who says that you're right about what's best for that society? So this whole idea, the atheist has no right to those terms. Only a believer in God has a right to those terms, because those terms are rooted in the existence of God. So notice what C.S. Lewis says. And C.S. Lewis has written several books. He does write a good book again. I give a qualifier in all of this. Some of these fellows have said things that we wouldn't agree with biblically. But when it comes to defending the existence of God, C.S. Lewis has written some good things. And he talks about this very issue because he was an atheist. And he didn't believe in God. And suffering was a major deal. And what he says is, I reasoned myself out of atheism by thinking about this idea of justice. So read with me. Hang in there with this. But let's work through it, because I think it's really insightful. C.S. Lewis says, and of course, that raises a very big question. If a good God made the world, why has it gone wrong? And for many years, I simply refused to listen to the Christian answers to this question, because I kept on feeling whatever you say and however clever your arguments are, isn't it much simpler and easier to say that the world was not made by any intelligent power? I mean, aren't all your arguments simply a complicated attempt to avoid the obvious? But then that threw me into another difficulty. My argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. Now stay with what he's saying. Okay, so my argument is the same thing J.L. Mackey is saying. You know, all this suffering everywhere. So he says, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? He goes on to say, if the whole show was bad and senseless, from A to Z, so to speak, why did I, who was supposed to be part of the show, find myself in such violent reaction against it? Of course, I could have given up my idea of justice, but if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too, for the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust. Not simply that it did not happen to please my fancies. Thus, in the very act of trying to prove that God did not exist, in other words, that the whole of reality was senseless, I found I was forced to assume that one part of reality, namely my idea of justice, was full of sense. Now, hang in there. This may be one of the best lines. Consequently, because you know a lot of our atheist friends say, well, you're just so you're so simple-minded. You need to think on a higher and deeper level. Listen to what C.S. Lewis says. Consequently, atheism turns out, I love this, to be too simple. It turns out to be too simple. I mean, if the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning. You can breathe for a minute now after C.S. Lewis. But here's the idea. If I'm talking to an atheist friend, I'm about to ask some questions. And if we're going to have this conversation, we need to have the conversation. So he brings up suffering, and I'm going to ask him, so are you saying that that's evil? Well, if he says no, that's going to be a tough one to defend. But if he says yes, I'm going to say, where did you get your idea of evil? Is that just how you feel, or do you think there's actually a standard outside of us that's absolute? It's right no matter what man thinks about it. Okay, where did that come from? Because it didn't come from us. We may have discovered some of that, but it didn't come from us. And so whatever comes up, oh, you think God is evil. Well, where did evil come from? You think God is immoral. Tell me, what do you mean by morality? Does it mean he doesn't do what you want him to do? Or are we talking about actually an objective standard? So while evil is a challenge for Christians, it's an even greater challenge for atheists. And while suffering may be somewhat of a challenge for us to consider, it's an even bigger problem for the atheists. It's so odd. They need God because that's where justice and right and wrong and truth and that which is false and that which is logical comes from. But they don't want to believe in God. So they have no ground for this. So that leads me to something else. Let's talk about morality. This is a biggie. Again, why does God allow suffering? Usually the question of morality comes up. Now we're going to come back around. We've got to talk about morality. Because I will tell you that if God does not exist, that's the answer. There is no such thing as objective morality. By objective, I mean outside of us. So subjective, just within us, we decide what we'd like to think about it. Objective would be outside of us, which means we didn't determine it. So is there anything, I mean, is it true that adultery is always wrong? Is it true that rape is always wrong? Is it true that the taking of innocent life is wrong? Or is that not the case? And so I want us to think some about this issue of goodness or the wickedness of an action. Here's what I want to ask you. Is goodness or wickedness of an action determined independently of social acceptance? So I think this is important because, you know, in a conversation sometimes you can be talking to somebody and they use the same word that you do. I mean, we're using the same words, but you realize we really don't mean the same thing. You're using a word one way and I'm using it another way. Well, if you're talking to a skeptic or an unbeliever, that happens a lot. So when an atheist talks about what is moral or morality, the only thing that could logically be meant by that is something that, and some describe it as a social contract, that is, any given society decides what they think is in their best interest. So one society decides, well, we don't want this. Another society says, yeah, that's what we want. So when they're talking morality, that's what they're talking about. And get this. Most atheists, if they're informed at all, will tell you the reason they want to say that murder, do you know why they want to say murder is immoral? It's because if we live in a society in which it's not immoral, yeah, I could go murder somebody else, but what does that mean? Somebody else could come murder me. So really, it's all about self-interest. It's not, you know what? You've been created in God's image. And so I would actually be desecrating God's image. And I would actually be violating my image as one who's been created in the Lord's image. And we would violate the opportunity to have relationship and to glorify God. Well, if I'm a skeptic, if I'm an atheist, I'm not going to say any of that. I don't believe in that. And so it's all about, well, if I can do it, you can do it back to me. And that's why we want to say that it's wrong. But let's define this a little further. So here are some questions. Here are some of those questions. What is the basis of objective moral values according to atheism? It's interesting because as Christians, as those who believe in the Bible, we can answer these questions, but if you're an atheist, how do you answer these questions? So, if I believe in God, moral values can exist independently of what men think. But if I'm an atheist, where do they really come from? Here's another one. What is the basis of human value on atheism? Now, it's kind of laughable, but when you think about secular humanism or humanistic influences that say, oh, we're elevating human beings, really? I mean, it's the Christian that believes that a human person has been made in the image of God. Atheism can't elevate a human being. He may think he's at the top of the food chain, but he's not elevating a human being. Here's another question. Why should we do the right thing and avoid the wrong thing? Is it just self-interest? Now, we're digging in here a little bit, but if somebody's going to say this superficial stuff about God not existing because of suffering, we've got to ask some questions. We have to ask you, how do you have objective moral values, or do you? We're going to have to ask, how do you have human values? We're going to have to ask, how do you know what the right thing from the wrong thing is? What is the basis of moral responsibility? There is no basis of moral responsibility if you deny the existence of God. Now, before we even get to the suffering, we've got to talk about these things. Because you're appealing to some of these things to say, oh, God can't exist along with human suffering. And yet the very basis of your argument can't even exist itself without believing in God, which you say you deny. Now, let me give you a taste of this. By the way, I'll make all these slides available. Lynn will have all of them. Okay? So, this is a man by the name of Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins, in my estimation, hates God. He is, and I may have mentioned this the other night, the older I get, the more my memories blur together. So if I did, you'll just have to look over it. But Richard Dawkins, wrote a book that was very popular. A lot of young people were reading it several years ago, and it was entitled The God Delusion. I don't know if you heard about it. And some of the real superficial things that I was talking about are dealt with. What was interesting to me is there were two men that wrote a response, and they're very well-educated men. And they just make the point, you know, in the particular area of science that Richard Dawkins may work in, he may be respected, but when he gets into, you know, what the Bible teaches, and he gets into philosophy and theology, he really doesn't know what he's talking about. That is what these men said. He wrote a book called The God Delusion. They wrote a book in response, and I read both of them. And I enjoyed the second one more than the first one. It was called The Dawkins Delusion. So you have The God Delusion, you have The Dawkins Delusion. But they pointed some of this out. But look at what I'm talking about. Atheism leaves no room for objective morality. And that's a serious consequence to us. I mean, if somebody's telling me there's no basis of objective morality, how do relationships even work? How could you ever even have a loving relationship? And so he says, there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil. There it is. I thought you were telling me God was evil. God can't be evil. You don't even think there is an evil. There is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pointless indifference. We are machines for propagating DNA. It is every living object's sole reason for being. What a sad, sad story that is. So let's think about this from the standpoint of Scripture for a moment. As a Christian, we have moral values, and they are grounded in God. Look at Genesis 1, verses 26 through 28. We're going to look at a few passages here. Genesis chapter 1. And look at God's view of human beings. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So male and female have been created in God's image. We don't share all of his characteristics. He's not saying we are divine, but we do share some of his characteristics, perhaps not in the perfection he has them, but that's the goal, is to be more like our Creator. And in James 3:9, he talks about hurting those who are in the image of God by what we say. And so remember when I told you, you know, here's the atheist. He says, well, if murder was okay, then somebody could come murder me. See, that's not really the basis of the values of a Christian. We just read Genesis 1, but in Matthew 25 and verse 40, you'll remember the Lord say, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. Jesus says, when you see the face of another human being, when you see somebody hurting, when you see somebody impoverished, when you see somebody struggling, when you see somebody fighting, suffering in a difficult situation, when you look at their face, I want you to see me. Because there is intrinsic value when you believe God created us in His own image. There is no intrinsic value if you don't believe that. If you want to know why the atheistic advocates have engaged in the murderous activity of abortion and why they would argue that this human person, this unborn human person, which if you look at all the scientific and medical data, it is clear we're talking about a human person. And they want to just say that's a piece of tissue. Because at the end of the day, they think all of us are just a piece of tissue. There is no intrinsic human value. And so the logical consequences of atheism are evident. So if I'm having a discussion and somebody says, hey, Bruce, I think it's evil for God to allow suffering and therefore I don't believe in God, I'm going to have to ask you where you came up with the idea of evil. And so here's what I want to say. Let's make this real simple. There are only two options here. There is no third option. There's only two that I know of. You either have to take a naturalistic approach, which is what the atheist takes. It's a denial of absolute and intrinsic moral values. And the very argument that the design that we see, the irreducible complexity that we see, and the more we learn, it only gets more and more and more complex, that we could ever say that nature in and of itself created that or made that or caused that. I just think that's irrational. I think it's unreasonable. And listen, I don't have to prove God exists in some kind of test tube. See, that's more of this stuff that you've got to prove concretely. No, here's all I have to demonstrate. All I have to demonstrate is the child of God. And all you have to demonstrate, and remember this, is that the most reasonable conclusion is that God exists. Because once you get there, you can say, yeah, I believe God exists. We walk by faith and not by sight, but we see His creation. When I look at the irreducible complexity of this universe, when you look at the human body, when you look at how DNA, RNA, and protein work, and just the raw amount of that data, brethren, what would be your most reasonable conclusion? That that happened randomly by accident? Or that there is an almighty creator? So, either we have naturalism or we have the idea of a supernatural cause of this, a first cause. And that would be God. So, no way to have morality. Don't talk to me about morality. Don't talk to me about good and evil. Don't talk to me about what's wicked. Don't talk about morality or immorality in any way to me if you don't believe in God. You're going to have to use another way to make your argument, and I don't think you can. All right? Now then, let's come back to that original idea we had. Remember the one that we read from J.L. Mackey? You remember that? That God, you know, a just God can exist alongside of human suffering. So here's the assumption, and we grant it as Christians way too much, and it scares us off, and I don't want it to scare us off. There is this hidden assumption in that statement, and if you'll pull that assumption out and start asking questions, then this whole thing ravels apart. So, here we go. Here it is. The assumption is, if human suffering exists today in our world, that it would be God would not be morally justifiable to allow that to happen. Okay, that's the argument. Everybody with me? Shake your head. If you're asleep, wake up right now. Good time. Okay, so that's the argument. It would not be morally justifiable for God to do that. Now, if it can be demonstrated that it actually is and would be morally justifiable for God to allow that, that He could have such purposes that He could allow that, then this whole argument against God goes away. In other words, if it can be shown that God can exist along with human suffering for divine purposes, then the whole argument goes away. Now, as we're coming into that thought, let me say something else, and this will bridge morality and what we're about to talk about. Okay. One of the sneaky things that atheists sometimes will say will be something like, so you think God created morality. Now, your gut instinct, if somebody says, hey, you think God created morality, might be to say, oh, well, yeah, God's creator, and I think He's moral, so He must have created morality. Wrong answer. I had a young lady, she was taking an intercession class in the summer, you know, those intensives you have to take because you want to get rid of it, and so get a credit for it. And so she called me up. Jewel called me up, and she said, hey, they call me Mr. Bruce. So she said, Mr. Bruce, she said, I've got this professor, and he asked us, do we believe that God created morality? We're going to lunch. We got to go back, you know, for the afternoon session. And he had a big smile on his face, and he's an atheist. And he said, all the Christians in the room, when you get back, I want you to answer that. I say, okay, give me a minute. I had to process this for a minute. I said, wait a minute, Jewel. I said, the answer to that question is no. Think about it. Morality, if you argue God created morality, then that means there was a time when morality didn't exist. And morality, moral standards, moral values have always existed. And the reason they have always existed, they're eternal. And you know why those moral values are eternal? Because they're grounded in the attributes of God. Okay, when we think about what's right or wrong, God's righteous. Did He create the attribute of right? No, He's always been righteous. So, I said, Jewel, I would tell him, no, God didn't create morality. Morality exists as God exists because without God there is no morality. And she called me back later and she said, hey, Mr. Bruce, I knew she was pretty happy when she called back. She called back and she said, you know, I answered that. And do you know what he said? I said, what? She said, he winked at her and said, good answer, Jewel, and just moved on. But what I'm saying is just think. Sometimes it's just the basic things of thinking through these wrong ideas. Now, come back to this. Is it morally justifiable for God? Listen again, if you're going to criticize the book, you've got to read it. So what does a Christian believe? Here's what we understand the Bible to teach. That God is loving, but He can't have a loving relationship with us if we don't have free will. Now, what does it mean to have free will? It means you can choose A or B. Somebody says, well, why didn't God make us robots? Because then we wouldn't have free will, and if you don't have free will, you can't have love. So God desired this loving relationship with us. You can go back to Genesis and look at creation and free will. But here's the thing about free will, brethren. If God creates us with free will, that means we have the potential to do good, but we also have the potential to do what? Evil. Now, did God make us evil? No. Did He make the world evil? Absolutely not. But He did give us the potential to make a choice. That's why the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is in the middle of the garden in the first place. So, God wants a loving relationship with us. There is the potential to do evil, and man did evil. Adam and Eve did evil. They transgressed God's commandment. But even then, God had a purpose and plan to bring us back to Himself, to overcome what would be the consequences of that sin. And so we read passages like John 3:16, for God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son that whoever believes in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. But you see, when Adam and Eve sinned, they opened the door to everything that comes with sin. You can read about that in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. And so when God created humanity, what did He say? He said it was very good. But in Genesis 3, notice Genesis chapter 3 and in verse 16, He mentions the consequences of sin. To the woman, He said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In pain you will bring forth children, yet your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. He goes on to say that cursed is the ground, verse 17, because of you, in toil you will eat of it in the days of your life, both thorns and thistles. It shall grow for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread, till you return to the ground. There's suffering and death. So God didn't create this suffering and death. It came upon us because of sin. We deal with suffering and death because God allowed such. Why did He allow such? God's not happy about the suffering that He sees. He's offered the solution to that suffering. But here's what He, through Christ, but here's what we have to understand. In the story, it doesn't start out evil. The atheist may not believe that, but he has to deal with that if you're going to criticize the story. The story starts out with a good creation and with blessed relationships, but He had to allow us to have free will, and if we violated His will, there had to be some level of the consequences of sin. Some have said, well, why would God, and I've wondered this, pretty good question, why would God permit evil and suffering? Again, I want to read from C.S. Lewis. He says, of course, God knew what would happen if they used their freedom the wrong way. Apparently, He thought it worth the risk. If God thinks this state of war in the universe a price worth paying for free will, then we may take it as worth paying. Think about what He's saying. What He's saying is, we think about our suffering. What kind of offense do you think all of this suffering and difficulty and chaos and challenges that we deal with and death and pain, how do you think God feels about it? And here's what we have to remember. God partook of it. God became flesh. God the Son came here and suffered and died. That's the story of salvation. It wasn't that God wound the clock up and said, well, now that's your problem. Even though we were responsible for it, at least Adam and Eve were responsible for it, God so deeply desires a relationship with you that He gave His only begotten Son. 1 Corinthians 15 and Romans 8 talk about the fact that we can overcome sin and death through Jesus and be raised. So, these are two big issues right here where we drop the ball sometimes. Maybe you haven't. That the atheist attacks. And I want to address it because I think it's critical. One is God's power. So we talk about God's omnipotence. An atheist says, wait a minute. If God is all-powerful, that means you think He can do anything, and then dot, dot, dot. They go from there. Okay, listen to me, brethren. The Bible does not teach. Hear me out before you write me up. Okay. The Bible doesn't teach that God can do absolutely anything. Listen, God can do anything that is in harmony with His will and His nature. Does the Bible ever say God cannot, and you fill in the blank? Why? God cannot lie. Hebrews 6 says that. God is light. In Him there is no darkness at all. Right? We could go on and on. There's some things that would violate the nature of God. And so when we think of God's power, this is what I say to my atheist friend. Now, wait a minute. You might misunderstand what I mean by God's power. God has power to do whatever is in harmony with His will, but you don't get to tell Him when He does it. So if you're thinking now, which we're going to come back to, well, He's got to do it right now or He's not God. No, He doesn't have to do it right now because you're not God. So, if we're going to talk about God's power, you don't get to use that one either. Here's another one, and this was a little tougher for even some Christians, I think. And that is God's goodness. So here's sometimes how we think about God's goodness. When things are going really well, you say, oh, I'm ready. I got to tell you, God is good. But when they're not going well, I don't know. If that's how we feel, we misunderstand God's goodness. And your atheist friend does too. Because this whole argument is, well, if God is good, there's not pain right now. There's not suffering right now. So, what are we talking about with God's goodness? Here's God's goodness. God's goodness means He put your interest over your whims and desires. You know, if it were up to me, I'd never have pain. Now, I know when we go to heaven, we won't have pain. But it's in the crucible of pain and hardship and difficulty that the Lord chisels out in us the image of His Son. Romans 8, I want you to turn over there and notice something with me. Romans 8, I want you to look with me at a statement that is made. Romans chapter 8, look at verse 17. He says that we're children of God, and if we're children, heirs also, heirs of God, and fellow heirs with Christ. Now listen to this. If indeed we suffer with Him, so that we may also be glorified together. So I'm all for the glory, but He says, if we suffer with Him. I'm sorry, I've read from C.S. Lewis so much tonight. This is the last time. But he says, we want, in fact, not so much a father in heaven as a grandfather in heaven. Sorry, grandparents. Whose plan for the universe was simply that it might be said at the end of each day, a good time was had by all. I should very much like to live in a universe which was governed on such lines. But since it is abundantly clear that I don't, and since I have reason to believe, now listen, nevertheless, that God is love, I conclude that my conception of love needs correction. This is so vital to see. Somebody says, well, if God's loving, He'll do what I want Him to do. If He's good and powerful, He'll do it right now. He'll do what I want Him to do. So therefore, if He's not doing what I want Him to do, and look, I know these things can be challenging, but if He's not doing what I want Him to do right now, then there must be no God. No. It means your view of God is too superficial. It means your view of God is too shallow. It means we need to dig deeper and understand that God has a much bigger purpose than we could have ever imagined. And we look forward to the resurrection. We look forward to being in His very immediate presence. And He calls men to come to Him. So rather than denying the reasonable conclusion that God exists, maybe I just need to try to learn more about Him. So, here's the answer to where we began. That kind of syllogism that we started with. Here it goes, okay? If this is the argument. If God is all good, He would defeat evil. If God is all powerful, He could defeat evil. But evil is not yet defeated, right? So the atheist says, therefore there's no God. But here's the problem. Because evil is not yet defeated does not mean it never will be. You got to read the end of the book, don't you? You know, I think there might be an argument here if there wasn't the promise of the resurrection and if there wasn't the promise of heaven. And so listen to this. If God is all good, He would defeat evil. If God is all powerful, He could defeat evil. Therefore, God will defeat evil, and He's presently working against evil right now. So therefore, the argument that if there's suffering, God can't exist. It's an illogical argument from the very beginning because he promises to conquer sin and death. You've listened very well tonight. I want to share one quotation with you that strikes me because of who it came from. There's a man by the name of Penn Jillette. You may have seen Penn Jillette. He's a hostile atheist. But he shared something that I want us to take home with us tonight as we've talked about it. You say, hey, Bruce, you preached all that time. You may say that anyway. But you preached all that time. And I believe in God. But can we share our faith with somebody who doesn't? And will we? Listen to what Penn Jillette said. He said, I want to talk to you about this. I get home after the show. There was one guy waiting over to the side after I was done. Big guy, probably about my age. And he had been the guy that helps with props. He walked over to me and he said, I was here last night. I was here at the show. He was very complimentary in a really genuine way. He said, I brought this for you. And he handed me a pocket edition of the New Testament. He said, I wrote in the front of it, and I wanted you to have this. I'm evangelizing. I'm a businessman. I'm sane, and I am not crazy. And he looked me right in the eye. And it was really wonderful. I believe he knew I was an atheist, but he was not defensive. Lesson here. He was not defensive, and he looked me right in the eyes. Other lesson. He was not defensive. He looked me right in the eyes. He was really kind, nice, sane, and looked me right in the eyes. Have you noticed how many times he said he looked me right in the eyes? And he gave me this Bible. I've always said, I don't respect people who believe and yet do not evangelize. I don't respect that at all. If you believe there is a heaven and hell, and people could go to hell or not receive eternal life, and you think it is not really worth telling this because it will make it socially awkward, how much do you have to hate someone to not tell them about salvation? How much do you have to hate someone to not tell them about salvation? I've always thought that, but this guy was a really good guy, and he was polite and honest, and he wrote me a little note and left phone numbers. I'll tell you, he was a good man. So maybe you meet somebody who needs you to look them right in the eyes because you love them and talk to them about God. Talk to them about Jesus. Don't be afraid. Just ask really good questions. And you can do that. We can do that. If you're not God's child tonight, the God that we've talked about gave his only begotten son. You can obey the gospel this evening and become a Christian and serve him faithfully and share the good news to the world. Come now as together we stand and we sing.